Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got Professor A.C. Grayling talking about the history of philosophy.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, I should begin with two comments, the first of which is, as you see, I've come very suitably dressed for a hot afternoon in the Chalk Valley. But it is more or less the middle of a working week, so I'm afraid my pastel trousers and cool shirt had to be left behind. The second thing you will notice is the modesty of the title of this book, The History of Philosophy. I mean, even the great Bertrand Russell decided to call his A History of Philosophy, which was... But I've endeavoured in this book to do two things, really. One is to present with clarity and comprehensiveness the great story of thought since classical antiquity to our present day. And not just in the Western tradition, although the Western tradition is wonderfully rich in philosophy and in philosophical thought, which has been immensely consequential. But I've also provided overviews of the philosophical traditions of India, China, and the philosophical work done in Arabic and Persian in the first 500 years of Islamic history, when Islam was still open, really, much more even than today, to the debates and inquiries that are distinctive of philosophy. This was because after the Arab conquests in the very early part of Islam's history, the area of the world that was overrun had been a Byzantine and Nestorian Christian area, and many of the texts of philosophy, many of the classics of philosophy, which had been almost lost to the rest of Europe, were still to be found there, and they were pounced on by some of the great minds of that tradition, and we have much to thank them for, because that meant that those texts were preserved and re-entered the European debate. But obviously, unless I talk very fast, I'm not going to be able to cover 2,500 years of philosophy in the next 40 minutes or so. So what I'm going to do is the following three things. Firstly, I want to just remind you of what philosophy is. I know you were all busy reading Plato and so on in bed last night, so of course you're very familiar with it. I just want to remind you a bit about it. And then secondly, I'd like to tell you something about how it began, because knowing how it began tells us something significant about what really is central to the great philosophical quest. And the third thing I'd like to do, and I will do it and weave it in, so to speak, in those two things there, is to give some sense of the trajectory of the history of philosophy, because that's an important thing to understand about it too, have a sense of framework about how the philosophical tradition has developed. And the reason for wanting to do that is, if you consider the history of ideas in general, so this would be not just the history of philosophy or the history of the religious traditions, but also the history of astronomy, the history of mathematics, the history of medicine, the history of engineering techniques. I mean, one could really start being very expansive in thinking about that great, great adventure, which is humankind's endeavor to make sense of the world, to achieve some mastery over aspects of nature, to make some sense of ourselves as complex beings in our relationships and our societies. So that's a very, very, very big story. But central to it has been the story of philosophy, because, of course, all those different efforts made to make sense of the world, to make sense of ourselves, have stemmed from, or they have involved, philosophical questions, distinctively philosophical questions. So let us remind ourselves what philosophy is. You can very usefully reduce philosophy to two great questions. And then you see that in order to make some sense of those questions, you have to break those questions down into sub-questions and sub-questions. Because, of course, the great technique in philosophy is that you have to creep up on difficult problems in philosophy from behind, when they're not looking. You've got to try and get in through the back door to make some kind of sense of them. Because imagine, supposing you stop people on the streets of Salisbury or the West End of London and say to them, what is truth? Well, if they don't call a policeman or an ambulance or something, and they do try and engage with you on that topic, you very quickly find that that full frontal assault, a sort of D-Day landing on the great questions of truth, is a very difficult thing to achieve. So you have to try to see ways of articulating the problem into more manageable bites. So the two great questions of philosophy are, what is reality? What exists? What is the universe? Where does it come from? And the second great question is, what matters? What's of value? What's significant? What's meaningful? What are the values and demands on us that would help us to live lives which are good and flourishing and meaningful? So the question about the nature of reality and the question of the nature of value constitute the two great endeavors, and you can see that they are related to one another. You can see very, very quickly and easily how they relate. Suppose your answer to the question of the nature of reality is that in addition to the physical world, to all the phenomena described and predicted by the laws of nature, there are also supernatural agencies of some kind, gods and goddesses or beings of some sort, either in or associated with the universe in some way. And suppose further that these beings are somehow interested in us, interested in what we eat and what we wear on what days of the week and whether we cover our heads or not and so on. Just if there are such beings, then the question of what matters, the question of our values, the question of how we're to live, is influenced by that fact. But now supposing that in your thinking about the nature of reality, you think the universe is a realm of natural law. It's a place of nature. There aren't supernatural beings. There aren't gods and goddesses. There's just the universe. Then that tells us that we ourselves have the responsibility of finding answers to the question of how we should live, of what matters, of what's good, of what's right, of what's wrong. So these two questions, whichever way you end up, whatever answer you end up with about the nature of reality, tells you something very significant about how we're to answer the question of value. But of course, as I said, if you do stop people in the street and say, what is real, you very quickly get into a problem. It's easy to illustrate this. There you are, you're standing on the pavement, you've got your clipboard and a pencil, you've stopped people, you've asked them what exists. They're prepared to go along with you. So what do they say? They say, well, trees, rocks, buses, people. You say, no, those are complex entities. When we're thinking about the ultimate nature of reality, we have to think what all the things are from which these complex things come. So you happen to have just stopped somebody who's, you know, also been reading a bit of something in bed last night. So he says, well, okay, there are elementary particles. There are quarks in the nucleus of the atom and leptons. Or maybe there are strings or superstrings or quantum fluctuations in the vacuum. And then you say to him, oh, quantum fluctuations in the vacuum. Well, that's very interesting. As you know, in the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum theory, you require observations to collapse the wave function. You all know about Schrodinger's cat, don't you? You've got to look in the box to see whether the poor blight is alive or dead. So you need physicists as well. So have we got quantum fluctuations in physicists? Are they the ultimate nature of reality? Well, of course, this immediately flags up for you the fact that on this palmy day, I believe it to be the 27th of June 2019, we don't actually know what the ultimate nature of reality is. However, it's a hot day, so you press on. You say, right, okay, there's something in physics, all right, number one. Number two, what else might there be? Are there minds separate from bodies? This is the old mind-body problem. You know, after all, you think about it, you think a thought doesn't have a weight or a color or an odor or a position in space other than somewhere in your skull. But a physical object does, has a location, a weight, a set of properties that are physical properties. So it looks as though mental things like ideas, thoughts, memories are different from physical things. So does this mean that mental things and physical things are not the same? Well, you remember Bertrand Russell used to tell the story of how his grandmother irritated the blazes out of him by saying to him, "What is mind? Oh, never matter. What is matter? Never mind." This idea that somehow they are very distinct things seems to be rather plausible. But on the other hand, if you take a big sledgehammer and you wallop somebody over the head with it hard enough, they tend not to do a great deal of thinking for a bit afterwards. There seems to be some connection between the brain and the mind. And indeed, the more that one examines it, it begins to look as though mental phenomena are secretions of the physiological activities in our central nervous system, inside our skulls. Anyway, number two, you put, okay, minds, you're gonna take a gamble. Put minds. And then what? If there are minds which are not bodies, why aren't there just anything you like which are non-physical? Why are not gods and goddesses and principalities and powers, angels, archangels, fairies, goblins, sprites, ghosts? You know, why not? If you're going to admit that into your ontology, as they call it, and ontology is a list of things that exist, why not include them? Well, now you've got a real rush of blood to the head. Number three, what are you going to put down as number three? Numbers? Do numbers exist independently of our overdrafts and so on? Now that you've got numbers, does redness exist as well as red things like apples and cheeks and noses and so on? But notice this, you've only got three things on your list and all of them are questionable. All of them are such that on the 27th of June 2019, we still don't know what exists. So now we've got a job of work to do. How are we going to find out what exists? Well, one thing we're going to do is we're going to ask ourselves the question, how will we know what exists when we come across it? And then we have to ask, well, what is knowledge? How do you get knowledge? What is the best way to inquire? What's the most reliable form of inquiry that will take us to truth? Ah, truth. What is truth? What's the difference between truth and a justified belief or opinion? Now, I could go on and on, but you can see how this is breaking down now into more and more refined questions. The question about reality becomes a question about knowledge, becomes a question about truth. Truth becomes a question about reason and inquiry. So already you're beginning to see that side of the story becoming more interestingly complex and complicated. And one thing you will notice about that, too, is that the enormous endeavor that our ancestors, our forebears, and our fellows in the human story have made to try to understand reality, try to understand our world, has eventuated in some ways of thinking about our world which have proved to be incredibly useful and productive. So in the 16th and 17th century, philosophy gave birth to the natural sciences. And that way of thinking about the structure and properties of the material universe, giving rise to physics, to chemistry, using mathematics as a tool to quantify the phenomena that we observe, has resulted via the applications of science through technology, so computers and aeroplanes and antibiotics, and we've had a wonderful flourishing of mastery over some aspects of nature and a much increased understanding of aspects of nature as a result of the fact that the philosophers of the 16th and 17th centuries began to ask their questions in ways that could be answered. And that gives us a really interesting clue to the nature of philosophy itself. I say to my students, I say, we humans occupy a rather small patch of light in a great darkness of ignorance. And on the arc, each arc of the circumference of that patch of light, there are people trying to look out into the dark, into the shadows, trying to see the shapes there, trying to extend the patch of light outwards, in history, in physics, in medicine, medical research, in psychology. But philosophy patrols the whole circumference, tries to help in seeing out there to see what the shapes are. This is what I mean when I say trying to formulate the right questions, because if you ask questions in the right way, it gives us a much better chance of finding answers to them. And that has been one of the major thrusts of the philosophical story since the very beginnings of that story. And you can see that at work in this endeavor to make sense of reality. But even though we've made such a lot of progress, still on the frontiers of the natural sciences, and indeed on the frontiers of some of the social sciences like psychology and sociology, There is still so much we don't know. Every discovery we make creates more questions that we need to answer. And on those frontiers, the questions being asked, whether they're being asked by philosophers or physicists or psychologists, are philosophical questions. Now, what about the question of value, of how we're to live? Well, here it's a value to cite the very important, seminal role, really, of no less a person than Socrates. Socrates, who lived in the 5th century, towards the end of the 5th century, before the Common Era, had as a young man gone to listen to lectures given by other philosophers and sophists, people who were asking questions about the nature of man, the nature of the universe. And he found that there were many competing theories, different ways of thinking about these things, different answers being given by different people. But what they weren't doing was they weren't investigating the question of what matters in life, of how we should live it. They weren't digging in deeply enough into questions about the nature of the good and worthwhile life. And so he began to challenge his fellow Athenians. He would say to them, in your view, what is a good life? And they would say, well, it is a life of courage, nobility, of generosity, of fortitude. And he would say to them, well, what do you mean by generosity? What do you mean by courage? And then he would find pretty quickly that they hadn't really thought through very carefully what it was they meant. Wonderful example is given in the dialogue by Plato called the Meno, which I'm sure you've all read. So you'll remember that Meno is a rich and handsome young man, comes on a visit to Athens, and after his day's business, given that there wasn't a lot of, one day cricket or football or anything, TV or anything to entertain the evenings, would do what they all did, was to get underneath an olive tree and discuss some great issue of the day. And one of the great issues of the day was, is virtue teachable? That is, are the upstanding citizens of Corinth and Thebes and Athens able to pass on to their offspring their own sense of uprightness and of virtue? This was a burning question at the time because ancient Greek teenagers were staying out late at night, drinking too much ouzo, getting pregnant, stealing chariots, doing wheelies around the city walls and so on, making a real nuisance of themselves, so we can thank our lucky stars that we don't live then. And he wanted to know, why is it that these ancient Greek teenagers couldn't be taught to behave? So he said to Socrates, is virtue teachable? Socrates said, I don't know. What? Meno was very surprised. He said, well, why don't you know? And Socrates said, well, because I don't know the answer to a more fundamental question, which is what virtue is. Well, Meno's gasp was flabbergasted. What? The great Socrates doesn't know what virtue is? How can this possibly be true? And Socrates said, well, I don't. Do you know what virtue is? Meno said, of course I do. Socrates said, oh, I've been looking for somebody all my life who knows what virtue is. This is wonderful. Tell me. So Meno ventured a definition, which Socrates demolished very quickly. So Meno tried another definition, and that was demolished pretty quickly too. And very, very soon, Meno said to Socrates, oh, Socrates, you're like a stingray. You've stung my lips and tongue. I don't know what to say. So Socrates said, good. Now that you know you don't know what you're talking about, we can begin to make progress. Now, this was his technique. His technique was to challenge people and get them to realize that they hadn't really worked out what they meant by these incredibly important ideas about what would really make for a good and a meaningful life. Now, one thing which is very significant to note about this fact, what Socrates was doing and why it was so important, was because he lived at a time in the history of the great civilizations when something important was happening. He was born about 10 years after Confucius died in China, and either 10 years after Gautama the Buddha was born or 10 years after Gautama died. We don't quite know the Buddha's dates, but they were near contemporaries. And this is a very significant fact, because one thing I want you to notice about those three great figures, great iconic figures, Socrates, the Buddha, and Confucius, is that they were all of them philosophers. They weren't preachers or priests or founders of a religion or, I mean, you know, the Buddha, of course, has been treated as the founder of a religion. You've all seen the movie The Life of Brian, so you know about the shoe, and so on. So, in fact, the Buddha asked his disciples not to make him into a religious figure. They were philosophers, And they were thinking about the question, how should one live? What is of value? For that reason, the German philosopher Karl Jaspers called that period of history the axial age. Axiology is the study of values, of ethics. The axial age, the age when questions of ethical concern really came into focus. And you see that Socrates conceived his own mission as being to get people to think about this. He, of course, was anticipating by a long way that remark that Bertrand Russell famously made. Remember, Russell said, most people would rather die than think, and most people do. So Socrates was trying to prevent this from happening among his fellows and getting them to think about these things. And by the way, this idea that that period in the sort of originating period of philosophy has this special character, there is actually a portrait of this in words by no less a person than Aeschylus. Well, the other thing you were all reading, no doubt, last night was the Oresteia by Aeschylus, probably this being Chalk Valley, in the original Greek. Well, you remember that the third of those plays in the trilogy, the Eumenides, has this very, very historically significant episode in it. Well, it's about this historically significant episode, which is about how things were changing in the view of civilization about what matters. Let me just remind you, okay? Because, of course, it has to do with what must be by far the greatest, most wonderful soap opera ever. The story of Troy and what happened after Troy. Now, you all remember that King Priam of Troy had lots of sons. He had son Hector, who was a great warrior. But he also had a son who was a bit of a nuisance called Paris. And as a result of being a nuisance, Paris was made to go out and be a shepherd for a bit. And while he was there, he was visited by the three greatest goddesses of the Olympic pantheon. Hera, the queen of the gods. Athena, the goddess of wisdom. And Aphrodite, the goddess of love. And they said to him, which of us is the most beautiful? And Hera said, if you choose me, I will make you a king over a great, great kingdom. And Athena said, if you choose me, I will make you the wisest of men. And Aphrodite said, if you choose me, you can have any girlfriend you like. He said, I'll choose you. So she gave him a magic girdle, or whatever it was, that had the potency. Very shortly afterwards, he was sent on an embassy to Sparta, the king of which was a chap called Menelaus, the younger brother of the great king Agamemnon. Now, Menelaus had just had a bit of good luck, which was that he had won a competition among all the Greek kings for the hand of Helen, the most beautiful, beautiful woman of ancient times. And all the kings had agreed before they competed for her hand that if anything happened, anything went wrong, they would all come together to remedy matters. So when Paris used his bit of magic that Aphrodite had given him to steal Helen away to Troy, Menelaus ran to his big brother and he said, that blighter has pinched my wife. Now we're going to get all the kings together and go get her back. So you remember that Agamemnon gathered together a fleet of 1,000 ships, sail off to Troy. She had the face, you remember, that launched 1,000 ships. This gives you a metric for beauty, which is that a millihelen is just enough beauty to launch one ship. So now you... Okay. And this great fleet of 1,000 ships got together in port and found it couldn't sail. The wind was against it, day after day. It began to stretch into weeks and they were very worried. It was obvious that one of the gods was against them. And so Agamemnon had an augur check this out, and it turned out that indeed a goddess, Artemis, the goddess of the hunt, was very angry with them because one of their number had killed a pregnant hare, and she didn't like pregnant animals being killed. And she demanded a sacrifice so that the winds would change. And the sacrifice was nothing less than Agamemnon's daughter, Iphigenia. So she was sacrificed. The fleet went off to Troy, 10 years, war, Trojan horse. They all came back again except for Odysseus. And when Agamemnon got home, this is where the real trouble started, because his wife, Clytemnestra, now number one, he had sacrificed their daughter. Well, that wasn't too good. Number two, he'd been away for 10 years and she'd taken a boyfriend, Aegisthus, and he wanted to be king. So she and he plotted the murder of Agamemnon. So no sooner had Agamemnon got home than they murdered him in his bath. Now this is where the plot thickens, because they also had a son, Orestes. And in those palmy days, in those Homeric times, it was the duty of a son to avenge the murder of his father. And since his mum had murdered his father, he had to kill her. So he did. And now he was in really big trouble because there was a set of chthonic deities, the Furies, whose duty it was to pursue and torment and ultimately to destroy anybody who murdered a parent. So they set to work on him. He tried to escape. He managed to get to Delphi. He told the god at Delphi, Apollo, he said, I'm in big trouble. This is what's happened. Apollo said, tell you what, I'll put them to sleep temporarily. You get yourself to Athens. Speak to my sister Athena there. She will sort you out. She's smart. So he managed to get to Athens. And Athena said, I am going to put you on trial. I'm going to summon a jury of the citizens of Athens to the Areopagus, just under the Acropolis there, and we're going to put you on trial. So they did. And Orestes had as his defense lawyer Apollo. That's not bad going, you have a god as your defense lawyer. And Apollo put the following argument to the jury. He said, Orestes is not guilty of parenticide because a mother is not a parent. She's just a receptacle. Anyway, half the jury accepted this argument, and Athena used her casting vote to set Orestes free. And just as she did so, who should turn up in Athens but the Furies? And as was their wont, they were furious. They said to Athena, now, in what they said to Athena, you hear the hinges of history changing. Aeschylus has captured the moment when an incredible change happened in civilization. Because the Furies said to Athena, you young gods, notice that, you young gods, you new gods, have usurped our role. It was ours to pursue and to punish a parenticide. And what have you done? You've got a bunch of people together, jaw, and you've let him off. And Athena said, yes, because we live in a new world. We live in a world where we have to think, we've got to debate, we've got to compromise, we've got to decide how we're going to live, how we're going to comport ourselves, how we're going to do things in society. We can't just rest content with the eye for the eye, tooth for a tooth, the old idea of revenge as a way of trying to restore justice in society, which is what you guys are all about, you Furies. No, we have to think anew. We live in a new world. This marks the transition from a way of thinking about virtues as warrior virtues. Notice this. The first half of that word virtue is the word vir, V-I-R. In Sanskrit, that word means hero. In Latin, it means man in the masculine sense. So virtue originally meant courage, strength, fortitude, endurance, the preparedness to kill and to die to protect your tribe or your city, the warrior virtues. And what Athena was saying was that we have to move to the civic virtues, the virtues of debate and compromise, the virtues of being able to live together, to form societies, and to work things out in peace. And this is why Socrates, living when he did, he was a contemporary of Aeschylus, wanted to get people to really accept that challenge, to think about what that meant. What do we mean by these new virtues? What is courage? What is kindness? What is generosity? What do we mean by the good? And how would you identify the nature of a good and worthwhile life? The values which govern, shape, and color the way we live. So that is the two great questions, the question of reality, the question of value, and the incredibly important Socratic challenge, really, which has been the source of the great debate in ethics ever since. Now, how did all this begin? Well, it all began before Socrates, obviously some time before, a couple of centuries, really. Obviously, given the great civilizations of Mesopotamia and the Nile, for thousands of years before classical Greece, before the 5th century Athens, these immensely organized, elaborate societies, there must have been plenty of people in them who looked up at the stars and thought, what the hell does it all mean? You know, how should I live? And what is the source of the world? What is reality? But we don't know about them. And part of the reason why we don't know about them is because, as you will know, people interested in history, that around about the year 1200 before the Common Era, 1200 BCE, there was some catastrophe in the Eastern Mediterranean and the world around the Eastern Mediterranean, which caused the collapse of the civilizations then existing, Mycenae and the Egypt of the dynasties and the Mesopotamian civilizations. This was the result of, I mean, there's a great deal of speculation about it, but the so-called sea peoples, nobody knew who they were, where they came from, but they flooded into that part of the world and destroyed those civilizations, and there was a dark age for several centuries. You know, archaic Greece was only about the 6th century before the Common Era that the archaic art of ancient Greece becomes present to us. Pisistratus had the Homeric poems written down for the first time in the 6th century BCE. So there was quite a long period of intermission. And in that period, a great deal was lost. So we start again, as it were, with the civilizations that we've been talking about, so the Western civilization, stemming as it does from Greece, and the Indian and the Chinese civilizations, more or less contemporaneously. With this kind of speculation, what is the world made of, and what matters? So where does the world come from? What explains reality? And the first person we know who offered a distinctively philosophical answer to that question is a man called Thales, who lived at the beginning of the 6th century in Miletus, in the Eastern Aegean. It was an Athenian colony in the Ionian part of the world. And we don't know his dates of birth and death, but we do know that he was flourishing around about 585 BC because he predicted the occurrence of an eclipse that year, an eclipse which so frightened two competing armies in Anatolia that the soldiers ran away from one another. So we know he lived there or thereabouts. And what we know about him is that he asked the question, what is the arche? Now that's an ancient Greek word that means principle or source or nature. What is the principle or source or nature of the universe, the arche of the universe? And he gave an answer. And the answer is that the arche of the universe is water. Everything is water. Everything comes from water. Now, he thought that because he noticed that water is ubiquitous. It is everywhere. It's in the sea. It falls out of the sky. The soil is damp. You cut yourself, colored water comes out of your veins. Chop down a tree, water oozes out of the tree. Water is necessary for life. If you don't have it, you die. Water produces soil. This was the silt that was washed down by the Nile every year. But famously, tons and tons and tons of soil were created by water every year, so that seemed pretty good. And the clincher was that water was the only thing he knew that could take all three forms of liquid in its natural state, solid when it froze into ice, and gas when it boiled away. So it was metamorphic. It could take on different forms. It's everywhere. It can take on different forms. It's essential to life. It must be the stuff from which the whole universe comes. Now, I don't know how many of you would agree with his choice of arche. Perhaps not many. But that's not the point. The point is this, that he did not go to ancient scriptures or legends or myths. He didn't try to give an explanation that was based on what had been handed down or what other people said. Not very long before his time, a century or a bit over, Hesiod, writing in his work, The Theogony, which was about the origin of the world, said, oh, the world comes from the marriage of chaos and night and producing, the earth and etc. Just legends and making things up. No doubt Hesiod himself didn't really believe it, but it was a sort of story. We all love narrative explanations. But Thales tried to work it out. He used observation and reason. He observed, he looked for the thing that is present everywhere and necessary everywhere, and capable of taking different forms, and he reasoned about it. So Thales is regarded as the first philosopher for that reason. Because he used observation and reason, because he didn't appeal to legend or myth or religious beliefs, but tried to work things out. And from that day on, we have had this more or less unbroken, continuing tradition of thought, which is philosophy. Shows you that the word philosophy, Now, it says in the dictionary, love of wisdom. That's really helpful, isn't it? Philosophy really be defined as rational inquiry, the attempt to make sense, to try to find the way of asking a question, framing a problem, so that we can make sense of it. From Thales' time through Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, who are gigantic figures, Plato identified pretty well all the crucial questions that need to be asked in philosophy, both about reality and knowledge and about questions of value. Aristotle, of course, was a universal genius who contributed very widely to logic, to biology, to meteorology, as well as to metaphysics and epistemology and ethics. He is responsible for the first great classic of ethics, which is the book called The Nicomachean Ethics. This gives me an opportunity, by the way, to open a little footnote here and point out to you that very often, you know, when people who are not completely acquainted with philosophy do encounter it, the first thing that they notice is that it seems to be full of long words like marmalade and corrugated iron and so on. It looks all very complicated, and even the word philosophy itself, you know, capital F, woo, philosophy, well, it'll be very complicated. And his great work of ethics is called the Nicomachean Ethics. Why? Well, because his son, Nicomachus, edited that work, prepared it for publication. So it's named after his son, Nicomachean Ethics. In fact, one of the great tragedies is that Aristotle, like Plato, wrote dialogues. Cicero, who lived some centuries later, said, and we all know that Plato's work is not only great philosophy, it's also great literature, wonderful, wonderful writing. And Cicero said, Plato's dialogues are made of silver, but Aristotle's dialogues are made of gold. Every single one of them is lost. We don't have any of them. And the works of his that we do have, and they're very copious, very rich works, were his lecture notes. And so his more sort of technical work that he used in teaching his disciples. And after he died, his lecture notes were edited, and people, you know, tried to give them names that denoted what they contained. So there's one called The Physics, because it's about reality, it's about nature. Another one, Sun did the Ethics, and so on. But when they were editing this collection of notes, which was about the nature of existence, where he was trying to analyze the concept of being, what is it for something actually to exist? They couldn't think of a title for this book. Gone with the Wind? Nah. Pride and Prejudice? Nah. They couldn't think of a title for this book. So because they had just edited a book called the Physics, they decided to call this one After the Physics, which in Greek is Metaphysics. And that's where the name comes from. So now you can see these names are actually harmless. Even though they've got lots of syllables in them, they're harmless as soon as you get to know them. So after Aristotle, we had the great post-Aristotelian ethical schools, the Cynics. You've all heard about the Cynics, about Diogenes, who lived in a barrel. And the Emperor Alexander said to him, "Oh, great Diogenes, what would you like me to give you? I'll give you anything you ask." And Diogenes said, "You can step out of my sunlight." Or the Epicureans. Now, of course, today we think of an Epicurean as somebody who likes to party a lot, likes to, you know, drink and have a good time and so on. But what Epicurus, who taught that we should pursue pleasure and avoid pain, what he meant by pleasure was sitting under an olive tree discussing philosophy. What he meant by pain was staying up late, being married, drinking too much wine. So he had a very different conception of what pain and pleasure was than we do now. And then, of course, the great tradition of Stoicism. Now, the Stoics. Stoicism was the outlook of educated people for more than half a millennium before, in the late 4th century of the Common Era, Christianity was made the official religion of the Roman Empire by the Emperor Theodosius I in the Edict of Thessalonica in 380 AD. This was the outlook of educated people. The Stoics taught this. They said, and it's a beautiful, deep outlook. They said, with respect to things that we cannot control, tsunamis, earthquakes, disease, aging, we must face them with courage. But with respect to things that we have some degree of control over, our own fears, our own appetites and desires, we must try to achieve some degree of self-mastery. And if we can live with courage to what is outside us and some self-mastery, with regard to what is within us, then we can live with nobility. That was the Stoic outlook. And by the way, it was that aspect of having courage to the outer which has given rise to our use of the word, or one use of the word, philosophical. It's illustrated by the story of the two old ladies on the Glasgow bus, one heard saying to the other, "My dear, you must be philosophical about this, don't give it another thought." That comes from Stoicism, the idea of having courage. So the great post-Aristotelian ethical schools were tremendously influential. And when you think about the magnificence of the classical Hellenic and Roman civilization, right up until its end in the 5th century of the Common Era, these were the frameworks of thought that buoyed and sustained this tremendous achievement of civilization there, as indeed it did also in China and in India. Their philosophical traditions were also tremendously important in the construction of those societies. I write about them in the book. I would love to have time now to talk a bit about those ones, and I just mention one thing about the Chinese tradition, because of course we're all familiar with the fact that Confucius, or in Mandarin, Gongzi, was such an influence on the whole of Chinese history. In fact, the examinations for the civil service in China was still focused on the Confucian classics right at the beginning of the 20th century. So it was a very, very, very long history, although it was intermitted several times for several hundred years. For example, during the Tang Dynasty, which is what we think of as the early medieval period, about the 7th to the 9th centuries AD. And again, during the Yuan Dynasty, which was when the Mongols invaded under Kublai Khan. But otherwise, from the time of the Han Dynasty, which is the first couple of centuries before the Common Era, first couple of centuries BC, the Confucian tradition was very significant in framing the Chinese mind. One of the intermission, the period, I suppose, just before Confucianism became significant, that he had lived a couple of centuries before, was the period of the influence of legalist philosophy. Now, this became very influential in China at the time of the Emperor Qin Shi Huangdi. He was the man with the great terracotta army in Xi'an. He was a ferocious individual. He'd been the king of a state, the state of Qin, and then he had noticed that all the neighboring states were very weak, and so he conquered them all, and he unified China, and he's regarded as the first emperor of unified China. And then he didn't want, you know, he wanted to get rid of the preceding culture and institute his own. And so he burned as many books as he could find and as many authors of those books as he could find all at the same time. And instead of them, he promoted the work of the so-called legalist philosophers, the greatest of whom was a man called Han Fei. And Han Fei, even though we probably wouldn't want to live in Qin Shi Huangdi's empire or be underneath the thumb of the legalist philosophy, nevertheless had some wise things to say. And one of them is, he gives the example of the farmer and the hare. He tells a story about how a farmer was plowing a field one day. In the middle of the field there was a tree, and all of a sudden a hare came racing across the field, and it smashed into the tree and broke its neck and died. And so the farmer cooked it and ate it, and it was delicious. It was so delicious that the farmer threw away his plow and sat by the tree and waited for another hare to come. And the example is meant to illustrate the fact that you cannot wait, you cannot expect a great king or emperor to come along every time. You can't expect a new prime minister to be any good. you can't hope that people are going to be able to solve problems. So what you've got to try to do is you've got to build institutions and practices and the rule of law which will ensure that not even the worst of people can really mess things up. This was his example of the farmer and the hare. I beg you to remember it. Well, this is an example of the wonderful insights that you can get from these great philosophical traditions, and you find them in the Chinese tradition as well. All of these traditions are very rich, and one of the things that I greatly love about them, well, two things really. One is the very vividness of the when you think about the lives of the philosophers and you think about the problems that they wrestled with and how they wanted to solve them, and you think about the fact that some of them were such marvelous eccentrics. Remember Empedocles, who was one of the pre-Socratic philosophers, became incredibly famous in his own day, and he was so admired. Troops of fans used to follow him everywhere. He was kind of celebrity. He was sort of Beatles of his time. And because of that, he didn't want just to die in the ordinary way, and people would say, oh, you know, he was mortal after all, and we thought that he was just so amazing. So he flung himself into the crater of Etna in order to disappear, you see. But unfortunately for him, he liked to dress in a rather flamboyant way, and he had a very spectacular pair of gold sandals. And Etna, having consumed him, belched out one of these golden sandals onto the lip of the volcano where it was found. And so people clocked what he had done to him. And there's a little poem about him which says, Empedocles, that ardent soul who leapt into Etna and was roasted whole. Well, he's just an example of many of the interesting characters who have fed into the great tradition of philosophy and have enriched it. But what you find in it is not only all this speculation which has given risen to science and social science. I mentioned to you the physics and chemistry came out of philosophy in the 16th, 17th centuries. Psychology came out of it in the 18th century. Sociology and empirical linguistics in the 19th century. Computer science, cognitive science, and AI have been hugely contributed to by philosophy in the 20th century and now. So it is a very consequential enterprise because it is about not merely navel-gazing and you know, dreaming on a star, but about really trying to make sense, really trying to understand. And the minute that we find ways of answering important questions, we've given birth to a new discipline which can be very consequential in our world. And so philosophy does indeed bake a great deal of bread. It's an exciting story. It's a very vivid story. It's got some very vivid characters in it. And I know that you are going to thoroughly enjoy reading more about it. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.